Our last case this morning is Boss GmbH versus Mercato USA, 2021-1793. Mr. Supko, when you are ready.
Good to get that off.
It's a complication.
Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the court. The district court's approach to summary judgment in this case was highly unusual, to say the least. Overlooking what should have been fatal defects in the defendant's showing on both obviousness and literal infringement, that rather than holding the defendant to the requirements of Rule 56 when seeking summary judgment, the district court overlooked those defects and made its own findings of fact divorced from any evidence that was presented by the parties.
But not divorced from the prior art, which is evidence, right?
The only evidence.
And the judge here said, I know this is unusual, but I can actually understand all of this, and it's clear to me what the teachings are for this particular prior art. Why is that? You're not saying that's never permissible. I don't think you could say that after wires and whatnot, but why is it impermissible here?
For a number of reasons, Your Honor. First off, the evidence that was before the district court with respect to the complexity of the technology flies in the face of the district court's conclusion that it was so simple that he could just look at these four references and piece them together without any explanatory testimony and decide that the asserted claims were obvious.
What about the intrinsic record? Can't the judge also consider that while looking at these other references?
The judge can certainly consider the intrinsic record, Your Honor.
Then you have the complaint, you have the answer, you have the patent, you have the written description. Then you have these other references. Why is that not enough? If the judge looks at it and says, given that this is not a sophisticated technology or complex technology, I can see what's happening here.
Well, first off, Your Honor, I would say the record suggests that it was not an unsophisticated technology. Both sides submitted evidence from their technical experts that the level of ordinary skill in the art required an engineering degree and several years of practical experience in a specific field of technology, a related field of technology. But even if you were to assume that these references on their face were understandable to the district court judge, who was aided by a technical advisor in this case, there was no evidence in the record with respect to how those references applied to the claims. There was no evidence in the record with respect to why a person of ordinary skill in the art would have taken these four references, combined them in a way that arrived at the invention that was recited in the asserted claims.
Counsel, you've asserted technical flaws in the proceeding, but frankly, it looks to me as though you've sued under a patent that is, you sued someone who was not infringing under a patent that is apparently invalid. The judge could look at all the prior art, and we can look at all the prior art. So you want us to send it back because of technical flaws.
I would respectfully disagree with that, Your Honor. The evidence that was put in front of the district court on the district court's claim construction was one-sided and unequivocal. There was infringement there. The only contrary evidence on literal infringement was testimony that was put forward by the defendant from its technical expert applying a different claim construction, a narrower claim construction even than the claim construction that the district court issued in its opinion, which we never had an opportunity to submit evidence to rebut. But with respect to the validity, Your Honor, I think it's easy for the district court judge with the aid of a technical advisor to say this is simple and I would be able to put it together in a way that arguably, from the district court's perspective, invalidated the claims, rendered them obvious. But that's an error in perspective, Your Honor. On summary judgment, the question isn't whether the district court judge and his technical advisor can understand the patents. The question is whether a jury, without the aid of any explanatory testimony whatsoever, would have been able to take these four references, decide what parts of these references apply to which claim, parts of the claims, combine them, apply them to the claims, and also make findings with respect to how or why a person of ordinary skill in the art would have made that combination. There was nothing in the record that would have allowed the defendant to present any of that supporting evidence to a jury at trial. So to say that a jury would have been able to put themselves in the position of a person of ordinary skill in the art and make a four-reference combination that the PTAB didn't even find obvious just defies it defies credibility from my perspective, but it also flies in the face of Rule 56.
Did the PTAB have all the references before it?
The PTAB only had two of the references before it. I think it's also notable, Your Honor, that the gist of the defendant's obviousness theory here was that there were Chinese proceedings on a Chinese patent, a German proceeding on a German patent. They found similar claims under their respective
laws. Right, but the
laws.
District court said, that's not a theory I can accept, right? I'm going to forget about the foreign proceedings. I've got the prior art. I can understand this. I can do, maybe with the help, but maybe even without the help of at least the revised Chow Declaration, not as evidence, but as essentially an additional lawyer's brief. And lawyers in their briefs all the time say, look at, you know, column 2, line 36, look at this. And what I don't have from the patent owner is specific challenges to specific aspects of the application of the prior art to particular claim elements or even the motivation. What I have are a series of, my goodness, the other side hasn't done enough, but nothing concrete. And it's very hard to get a grip on why the procedural unusual features make any difference here without the concrete presentation that you didn't make.
Fair point, Your Honor, but the reason that concrete presentation wasn't made is because the defendant never put forward anything even remotely comparable to what the district court put in its decision about which portions of the references were being relied upon, how they were being combined, and why they were being combined.
It seems to me that had you rebutted strongly at the summary judgment, we may be looking at a different case, but you didn't.
The obligation was on the defendant to at least establish that there was a triable issue with respect to the factual findings that underlie any obviousness defense. Under Graham, it's got to be the scope and content of the prior art. It's got to be the comparison of the prior art to the asserted claims, and it's got to be the how and why a person of ordinary skill in the art would have made that combination. The sum and substance of the obviousness theory that was articulated, it appears on pages 16 and 17 of our brief. It was a quote of the claim with footnotes to the Chinese and German findings and four of the references with no pinpoint sites, no page sites whatsoever, pointing us to what portions of these references they were relying on or how they were putting it together. It's also notable that the foreign proceedings that they were pointing to didn't apply the four reference combination that the district court ended up applying. The Chinese proceeding was applying two references out of the four. The German proceeding was applying two other references out of the four. It was only the district court that put those together, and it was only the district court in its summary judgment decision that articulated how it was putting those together. We never had anything to rebut. Our response was the obviousness defense that the defendant was putting forward in its briefing was based on the foreign proceedings. And the district court judge agreed with us. It struck the Sao affidavit. But, and going to your question earlier, Judge Toronto, the district court didn't say, okay, I'm not going to look at the foreign proceedings. I'm going to read from the district court's opinion at Appendix 24. The district court said, when Mr. Sao's affidavit is accepted as attorney argument, Mikado sets forth each claim element of the asserted claims, summarizes the applicable prior art reference, and by extension from the foreign decisions, applies the prior art reference to the asserted claims. So the district court judge was relying on the application of the prior art from those foreign proceedings, the rationale to develop its own obviousness defense here. So, and just that reliance, I would disagree with Your Honor about the appropriateness of the district court judge saying, okay, I've got inadmissible evidence here. I'm going to ignore the inadmissibility of it, and I'm just going to accept it all as attorney argument. Rule 56 requires, and the case law out of the Federal Circuit and the Sixth Circuit says that if you've got inadmissible evidence, you can't rely on that for summary judgment purposes. So it's inappropriate to say, okay, I'm just going to convert this and pretend it's attorney argument. This was inadmissible evidence that we challenged, and it was excluded. So it should not have been relied upon by the district court judge. Now, I'd like to speak briefly about the literal infringement issue and the district court judge's approach to that. We were never given an opportunity to present evidence on literal infringement under the district court's revised claim construction. And you might say, okay, well, it wasn't that different. The district court can look at can look at the accused product, can look at the claim construction, can make a factual finding on its own as to whether or not there's infringement. But it's important to note here that the district court didn't have evidence from either side applying this claim construction for purposes of infringement. We absolutely would have created at least a disputed issue of fact with respect to infringement there. In fact, there was testimony from our technical expert that was cited, somewhat anticipating a portion of where the district court was going that would have been sufficient to at least create a disputed issue of fact. So I had reserved time for rebuttal. I'd like to continue to reserve that, and I'm not certain whether that time is my 15 minutes countdown or my 11.
That's your remaining time for rebuttal.
I'm sorry?
That is your remaining time for rebuttal.
Okay, so barring other questions from the court, I'll save the rest of my time for rebuttal. All right.
Mr. Newman.
Morning, Your Honors. Jason Newman on behalf of Mikado. May it please the court, I'd like to respond to some of the discussion here earlier today. First off, in terms of the citation to page 24 in the opinion for the district court on the summary judgment finding where he uses the phrase extension from the foreign decisions. I don't read that as giving any reliance on the actual substance of the foreign decisions. I think he's using that in the context when he's referring to the affidavit and just how it's structured in terms of describing or pinpointing how those references, the specific portions of the references can be seen in terms of the the claims are set forth.
How do you see those foreign references factoring into the judge's decision?
I think he was very clear that he was not relying on them. I think that.
But he did rely on them, right? I mean, to some extent, or in relation to them.
I mean, I think in some relation, it gets perhaps a little complicated with the way the Chao affidavit, at least in its original form, was presented, in that it did discuss it in terms of the foreign references, and that was done to try to compare the work in the Leone testimony that the Chinese patent was the same as the U.S. patent, at least it served the same claims. And so there was discussion in there to try to link the two. But I think when the judge, in his opinion, I think when he looks at that, he's very clear that he's not relying back on the outcome of any of that. I think, if anything, Your Honor, it's just in terms of showing where in the references that we cited and the court relies on, you could find that more pinpoint citation than just the than just the document itself.
But your problem is the court made its own fact findings based on attorney argument.
Well, Your Honor, to that point, I think that what he looks at in that attorney argument, there's nothing in the Chao affidavit that is new or is not independent of what's in those four references that he looks at. So he may look at it in some regard to see those specific places, but I think in terms of whether or not a lay jury could understand that, a lay jury would also have the benefit of opening and closing arguments. There's also, I think, in Weir's, in the concurring opinion, they note that in invalidity decisions, trial courts are, encouraged to give special interrogatories on that issue, to have jury instructions on that issue. So I think there are ways in which a lay jury could find, could take a look at this. And I think even in terms of just visually looking at some of it, which obviously all of these patents include figures to aid in reference, and I think the visuals that the trial court put in its brief are very telling on the issue, and even in terms of in terms of describing, I think the main one is the Schlecht reference, which is the aluminum guide rail version of what the 695 patent is. It says on page 35 of his opinion in order that Schlecht, with exception of not being a two-part guide rail design, is almost identical in overall configuration to the 695 patent. It has a common common inventor. It is the same owner of the patent. And then if you look at the 695 patent, even in the description of itself, and this would be at Appendix 74, where it states the combination of the plastic and the aluminum part is not rattle-free under all circumstances, and that's why the 695 patent is drawn to creating the rail system, the plastic guide rail system. Which then you can see in the other two references, almost right on their face, that has been done in the prior art before, that two-part system to then combine it back. So I think even essentially looking at the figures, you can certainly gather. I would say a lay jury could gather additional curiosity from that if they wanted to then look at the reference numerals and the citations. I think there certainly is basis for a lay jury to make those findings. Also just want to point out that this would be in the Eastern District of Michigan. That particular district is the world headquarters of three automotive manufacturers, a number of suppliers. I think that a lay jury in that district would be more than capable of making those findings. And in regard to the technical advisor, to that point, There was the order when we agreed to that the communications between the technical advisor and the judge would remain confidential. We wouldn't know about those. I know there's reference to the number of hours that the technical advisor put into this. He also put, obviously, from the court's opinion, a lot of time into the infringement issues. And I think that infringement issue is the much more complex issue when you look at it, determining whether or not there's that groove slot, however you want to think about it, in that particular issue. So I don't think we can just look at the number of hours and assume that he must have dedicated this all to the invalidity side, and that was extraordinarily complex, because I think when you look at it, as the judge found, that particular issue under these particular circumstances wasn't that particularly complex.
Do you have anything to say about the agreement about a relatively high level of skill in the art for the person of ordinary skill in the art here?
Yes, Your Honor, and I think that really goes to, you probably would need a high level of skill in the art, and certainly we retained an expert in injection molding to really address those issues on the infringement side. The issues of, how do you look at this particular product to determine, you get into a situation where the claim construction is a long, narrow channel cutter depression, and then to understand what that would mean and how that would apply to the part, I think that is the part that you really need the high level of skill in the art to understand. I think when it comes to the issue at invalidity, that issue isn't at issue at all in terms of invalidity, because I don't think there's any dispute that the Nagano patent or the Gassman patent have both a groove arrangement as put forth by either side. So I that's the distinction that I would make, Your Honor, is that when we're talking about that, perhaps requiring a bachelor's degree or more, I think that's more in the terms of the infringement side, and I think that's where testimony on those issues were directed, was to the infringement and to those issues of looking at the orientation and trying to determine the structure of the guide rails in those two parts and how they work. Address the PTAB, it did have, it didn't look at the same four references. I believe it had the Schlecht patent and the Beck reference. I don't think it looked at the other two. And in terms of the claim construction there, with the two sidewalls, that was done in reference to the figure 13 of the Schlecht patent, because the argument for the TTAB was a 102 decision, and whether or not there was a slit in figure 3 that might have shown two grooves coming together in that. So I don't think that the PTAB decision is particularly helpful or instructive under these circumstances. In terms of the literal infringement, I don't think that, number one, I don't think that there is a big change at all in the claim terms, how they were originally constructed and how they were constructed in the court's order here. I think that there are several items that are instructive of why this wouldn't require a remand. The first is that the court is very clear in its claim construction that it was adopting all of the dictionary definitions. It was very clear that it was making this on a preliminary basis, but it did say that it was adopting all of those. When it does do its modification, it adopts the further language from a dictionary definition that BOS put forward. Even in BOS's challenge in the summary judgment proceedings, they raised that we were misapplying the claim construction, or Dr. Malloy was in his testimony. But even if it was, and they recognized that was put forth. Mr. Parker had that at his deposition. He knew what Mr. Malloy's testimony was. He acknowledged that he had read the dictionary definitions, that he had read the court's claim construction, And you know, even barring that, he didn't have you know, additional testimony that, oh, you know, if Dr. Molloy's opinion, which we believe is impermissibly broad, is adopted, here are the reasons why, you know, that wouldn't matter. This project would still infringe. And on pages 50 through 54 of the court's opinion, he goes through the what the district court describes as the first and second alternative infringement arguments. And so he goes through what was presented by BOS at the summary judgment hearing in terms of how they would essentially still infringe, and he went through those and found that that there was no infringement, that the they would still have to be, because of the use of the term elongation in the claims and the use of the claim construction for groove to be long or narrow, that the groove would have to be long in the elongation direction and narrow in the width direction. So he addressed those concerns, Your Honor, and obviously made the findings that he did. We would ask that the court affirm the district court's decision, and unless there are other questions, I'll yield back my time.
Counsel, you should know that I found your brief to be full of misspellings, 10 or a dozen misspellings. We're used to a higher quality of a brief here, and while it isn't going to affect whether you win or lose, I think it is important for you to know that we did note that and think ill of it. So,
I appreciate the constructive criticism, Your Honor, and I regret that that occurred.
All right. Mr. Supko has a little over 2 minutes rebuttal time.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll try to be brief and just address some of the issues that Mr. Newman raised. First, on his last point, he said the judge anticipated the infringement issues at the summary judgment hearing. Well, that's just not true. The judge didn't issue his modified claim construction until he issued his summary judgment opinion. So we weren't discussing the claim construction that the judge ultimately based his summary judgment of no literal infringement on. And just for illustration purposes, I've got the infamous second part with me. The whole case is about whether this is a groove. I can promise you, had we been given an opportunity to present evidence under the new claim construction, our expert would have said that's a groove. At the very least, there would have been a disputed issue of material fact. Counsel also suggested there was enough in the record to put us on notice, I believe, of what their obviousness defense was. I'll just cite the court to the Cooper v. Ford case, 748 F. 2nd, 677. At page 680, this court said, the federal rules do not contemplate that a court may dispose of a cause by summary judgment when the basis for the judgment was not raised by the movement with sufficient precision for the non-movement to respond. We had one quoted claim with footnotes, no pin sites, citing to inadmissible evidence. From that, the district court wrote 45 pages of a 60-page opinion of its own findings, not based in any evidence in the record other than the district court and the technical advisor's own interpretation of the four references. Counsel tried to sidestep the high level of person of ordinary skill in the art as infringement related. This court knows full well that's a very important issue with respect to an obviousness analysis also. Counsel also suggests the jury was fully capable of looking at these references with the argument that would come in and making a finding that the patent is invalid, the claims are invalid. We're not talking about a sufficiency of the evidence test after a jury trial here. We're talking about summary judgment. The defendant was obligated to come forward with evidence not only that supported an obviousness finding, but would have compelled as the only possible conclusion that these claims were obvious. I see that my time is up, Your Honors. Unless you have some questions, I'll rest.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under submission.
Thank you, Your Honor.